Hi, I'm Michael Senoff, founder and CEO of HardToFindSeminars.com. For the last 5 years, I've interviewed the... For the last five years, I've interviewed the world's best business and marketing minds. Along the way, I've created a successful publishing business, all from home, from my two-car garage. When my first child was born, he was very sick, and it was then that I knew I had to have a business that I could operate from home. Now my challenge is to build the world's largest free resource for online, downloadable MP3 audio business interviews. I knew I needed a site that contained strategies, solutions, and inside angles to help you live better, to save and make more money, to stay healthier, and to get more out of life. I've learned a lot in the last 5 years, and today I'm going to show you the skills you need to survive. Hi, this is Michael Senoff with HardToFindSeminars.com. You know, a lot of people have Art Hamill's course right now, and I continue to get other questions asking about the support that Art gives for his course. Well, here are some of the questions, and what I do is when I get a question, I generally just pick up the phone and call Art. I ask the question on your behalf, and I get his answer. I record the call, and I provide you the answer directly to you. Some of these questions have been piling up, and I've asked Art all these questions that have been coming by ways of email from the Art Hamill students, and that's why I've added this new recording to cover more questions and answers from existing Art Hamill business buying course owners. So hopefully these questions will cover some of the things that you're thinking as you go through the course. I hope you enjoy. Here's a guy, his name's Anthony. Michael, I know I have emailed you earlier with a couple of questions for Art. If you haven't spoke to Art yet today, if I can replace those questions, if I may. The main question I have for Art is, how is the deal structured? What is the return for investors, Art's fee, and what percentage will the buyer own? Also, the exit strategy for the investors. How is it after a set number of years one is able to buy these investors out? Thank you, and I appreciate all your help.
When you're going out to buy a business, let's take a middle-of-the-road thing, manufacturing, and let's say your return is 25%, okay? When people go out to buy businesses in the United States or all over the world, our investors are looking for a return of anywhere from 25 to 33%, depending on the risk. In other words, a manufacturing company might give you a 25% return, whereas something riskier like a service business might give you a 33% return. Okay. Now, let's say you buy one and there's a 25% return. I then take you to the investors. But we have investors with cash. We have investors with real estate. And of all the years we've been doing it, the most we have ever given away is the equivalent of 12%. Now, if you have attended any classes in math, you realize when you buy a business and it's going to give you 25% return, on the other hand, you're paying your investors 12, that means you're going to end up keeping 50-some percent of the business even though you've put up very little or no money. Now, it varies. Taking California today, if I were working with people in Southern California and using their improved real estate that was free and clear, their cap rate runs 2.5% to 4%. So you might be able to, if you were working with people from Southern California or people that were used to getting less return, you might end up keeping 70% of it for 75. Now, keep in mind, what we're doing is we don't have a standard. In other words, we try to give them usually 20% or more than they're getting right now. And there's three things we're pushing with people when they invest. Number one, we're going to give you more return right now. We're going to give you more growth in the business that we're buying. And the third thing is comparable risk. In other words, the business that we're buying is as safe as the investment you have right now, or even safer. So those are the three things that we keep pushing, and it works very well. My fee normally runs 10%. Now, say you wanted to raise $10 million, my fee would be $1 million. Let's use that as an example. Okay, because let's look at it. You say you pay me $1 million. Before you start to worry about that, keep in mind it's going to take you $10 million to buy the company, which we'll deliver. I will deliver the $1 million that you're going to have to pay me. On top of that, you're going to have attorney's fees and CPA fees. So what happens is we would end up saying to you, okay, we're going to deliver $11,500,000 from the investors. So when you get to your close, You have enough money to cover everything. In fact, you could probably throw in $300,000 or $400,000 for working capital. So we make it, say, $12 million. So that's basically what we're doing. Now, if you want to analyze where I'm coming from versus you, if you go in and buy a company and say it's priced at $10 million, and let's say it's doing $2.5 million a year profit, you're going to end up getting half that. So you're going to get $1.25 million to $1.5 million, depending on how much stock you end up keeping. You're going to own half or more than half of a company worth $10 million. So at the close of escrow, you pick up $5 million in true net worth that you can go to the bank with, and you pick up an income of $1.5 million a year, which you didn't have before. Michael, I've told you many times, I'm looking for something else to work on. I was looking forward to working with other people.
Right.
So it's not a money thing, because it would be easier for me to put that business deal together for myself than trying to put it together for someone else.
All right. And so he also wants to know what kind of involvement. Let's say that he doesn't have a ton of managerial experience, and then this thing goes down. What kind of involvement is he going to have on a day-to-day operation?
You mean running it?
Yeah.
Okay, well, here's what's going to happen. The investors are going to dictate a lot of that. If he has a good management experience and is going to be able to run this, and again, it doesn't mean you're going to be running the thing on a day-to-day basis. You can be an absentee owner. Okay, we leave the management in there. You don't want to get stuck in this thing of being there every day. That's crazy. And the investors don't care about that. But what they do with me is, number one, if the person coming in is not putting up enough, they insist that I put up part or all of what I get. Okay, this has been my experience for 25, 30 years. The second thing that happens, if you don't have a lot of experience, not only will I still own part of the company through the stock, the other thing is I have to either be the consultant or the chairman of the board or the CEO. In other words, I'm going to have to run that company until you, the buyer, end up getting to the point where you can run it yourself. And also, I would do that anyway, because if I own part of the stock, I don't want to end up losing the whole thing because you can't manage a company. I'm not trying to make the managing of the manager a big thing. It isn't. The problem is where my head is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, in other words, if you're not coming forward with anything, again, could I put the deal together if you had not 1 cent? Yes. Could I put it together if you had no experience? Yes. Could I put it together if you had no management experience? Yes.
Okay.
But if you're bringing, and again, I'm not talking about bringing a lot of money to the table. It's tokenism, because what happens is, if you're an investor, somebody coming in to buy a company invests nothing or next to nothing in it, guess what's going to happen when the company has trouble? The buyer is going to leave. He's going to walk out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what everybody worries about, and I don't care what country you're in. That is a legitimate thing. So, and one other thing that he asked about going out, the average investor will stay for 5 years. So we set the pro forma up. We set up 5 years of projections of what the company's going to do. The person that's putting, say, $1 million in, because that's our minimum that they put in, they put $1 million in, they're earning 8% on their investment now, and we're going to give them 10, which is 25% more, okay, which is pretty good. And what they're going to look at is, okay, I'm going to have a certain percent of this company where we're making so much this year, and I'm going to be making so much for the next 4 years.
So if it's a $10 million business, you're going to get, for example, 10 investors to bring in $1 million, and they're going to make a couple points more than they're already making with real estate.
Or with money.
Or with their money.
If it's real estate, the example I've always used over the years has been a 10% cap rate.
Mm-hmm.
Most real estate around the country does not earn a 10% cap rate now. Okay, the cap rate's lower. So we don't have to pay as much right now. But even when we get back to the point where we have a lot of 10% cap rates, and we will soon, it always goes back to this, it still makes economic sense.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, everybody can argue with me about how this works. It doesn't work. But if you go out and check the numbers, this is what you're going to be able to get it in the market for. This is what the investors ask for. And if you just figure the arithmetic, this is how much you end up with. It seems to be obscene, but it's what the market is.
All right, so what happens 5 years? Let's say a deal goes down and Anthony buys a business, you know, using your investors. 5 years has passed, and then the business has – the investors want out. What happens after that point?
Okay, at the point in 5 years, what happens is you can either sell a company, okay, and pay them off and pay yourself off, or what you can do is get the thing appraised and give them the appropriate share of the value of the company. And the company's going to be free and clear, so if you had to borrow on it or whatever, you'd have no trouble buying out the investors. Now, what we normally do is we're giving their money back. So the person puts up $1 million. At the end of 5 years, or during the time, they're getting more return than they ever got before. They're getting more growth, and they're also getting comparable risk. Okay? At the end of 5 years, we give them $1 million back, whatever they put in, and then we give them a percent of the profit of the growth of the business, which is substantial usually in a five-year period. Usually, over the years, what I've done is I've given the investors half of the upside. I'm the only one that's ever done that. Everybody I've worked with is only giving them 25%. Incidentally, they are very satisfied with 25%.
All right, here's another question. We've talked about this on the part where we went over the 25 criteria. He wants to know, when he's looking for businesses, should he be looking for manufacturing businesses? Are these the businesses that you most prefer dealing with, and the reasons why?
Okay. First of all, most of our investors are owners of manufacturing plants, so it's easy to sell them. The other thing is, it's also a favorite with me. But the number one reason is the risk factor. You pay a little more for the bucks that you get from a manufacturing company, but what you're going to find is the risk factor is a lot less. The chance of failing is less. The competition is less. On the other hand, you have service businesses that you can buy for a better price. The amount of cash flow for every dollar of profit. But they're going to drive you nuts. And if you ever owned a service business and you own a manufacturing business, it's very obvious what the problem is. The more people you have to earn that $1 million a year, the more problems you have. I mean, it's not your equipment that's going to drive you nuts. It's those damn people. You know, they used to have that song, "We'll take this job and shove it." When I'm out there and I hear that song, I'd say, I wonder if these people realize that we owners have a song like that also.
Yeah, I believe it. I just talked to a buddy of mine who bought a franchise down in Sarasota, Florida, called Cheeseburger Cheeseburger. It's a cheeseburger, you know, cheeseburger restaurant. And it's doing great. It's busier than hell. But he says the biggest damn problem is the employees. And he was telling me the story about how his manager called, and the guy's like 21 years old, and you just can't find help to manage and waitress on these restaurants. And he had a problem with his girlfriend. He's a shift manager, and he couldn't come in. And my friend said, look, you either come in or you're fired. He goes, well, I don't think I'm going to be coming in. He says it's just a nightmare.
The big problem you have is there's no tips involved. And out here in Orange County, you know, it's very expensive to live here. And I have a couple of friends, or a few friends, that own restaurants, and they all complain about the same thing.
That there's no tips?
Well, if they have a business that doesn't require tips or give tips to the people,
yeah. The
employees can't make enough money to live. The example I used to always use, we owned a lot of fast food operations, hamburger operations.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say, okay, in order to make $50,000 a year, I need 50 employees. But the thing is, okay, I don't make $50,000, I get 50 people. This was like a few years ago. If I want to make $100,000, I have to have 100 employees. And I have to have, for every $50,000 I make, I have to have a manager. If I want to make $1 million a year, I have 20 managers reporting to me. With a manufacturing plant, I only have one person. The manager of a small fast food operation might be paying, what, 50, 60 grand a year? The managers of the operations we have in manufacturing make 150 to 200,000 a year. You know how often people call you and they make 200,000 a year? They think you're a dork anyway. You're the buyer, also known as a dork, or whatever else, other names they call you. I never did find out what they called me, but I'm sure it wasn't very complimentary.
Right. As far as manufacturing, with today and everything being outsourced to China, like all the mold and the tool dye business, has that changed your opinion on manufacturing? Is that a concern? And why not?
First of all, you're going to run into a lot of larger companies that are already outsourcing. And in the old days, you know, we were in outsourcing before there was a word called outsourcing because we were in Mexico for all those years. And that's what we were basically doing. We weren't the U.S. company outsourcing. We were the outsourcing source in Mexico, taking over all these jobs and stuff like that. It comes up all the time, but what you're going to find is most of the companies that are large enough and it makes sense have already gone offshore, either to the Far East or to Mexico. And I'm not saying you can't do it in the future. If you run into one and it's a simple product and it's something you might be able to do with, I mean, that's a hell of a deal. Like that, we were working on a furniture business in downtown L.A. They have 200,000 square feet. They had 300 employees of furniture manufacturing. They moved it to China, and last time I was there trying to buy it, they had only 70 employees left. And where they had a business before, they were making $400,000 or $500,000 a year. They were making $2 million some with the savings on the labor. So, yes, it's out there. Something you have to keep in mind. what we did, even though our plants in the U.S., we always outsourced. I always went to Mexico. And what I would do is I'd have 100 employees at $10 million a year in sales. If we then had a big burst in sales, instead of me adding people or trying to add more manufacturing facility, I would go offshore with it. And then what would happen is as soon as the business would go back to where it was before, I would pull the jobs back in from Mexico.
Have you done any stuff in China or any?
Yes.
What's your opinion on outsourcing to China?
Well, first of all, if you have proprietary products, they're going to steal it within 1 hour.
Yeah.
They're going to be manufacturers themselves. They're also hard to work with. I mean, I never had any trouble working with the Mexicans. Working with the Chinese especially, they are a bunch of hard asses. Their word is no good. Because the problem is, again, after you settle down and you have the contracts, it's okay. But up until that time, if you sign a contract on Thursday in blood, on Friday they'll be back making changes in it. Kind of same thing on Monday. In fact, when I taught seminars, the Asians in my class would consider me racist because of what I was saying. I say, listen to what I'm telling you. I'm not going to tell you, don't do business here. What you do is learn to negotiate. In other words, you know they're going to come up with something to get you to change the price. So what you do that night, if you sign a contract, make up four or five things. In other words, if they change the price on it, they have to give them all their children and all the grandchildren in the next 5 years. I said, come up with something really obscene, four or five things. And then come up with little nitpicking ones. And when they hit you with the nitpicking things in the beginning, say, you know, I'm glad you want to open the door again on this negotiation because as I looked at this last night, I found the following three or four things that we might want to change. And as soon as you come back and start doing that, they back off every time. You know, if you're in the Middle East, you have the same problem. People like to negotiate. You know, up until the time we got involved with investors 25 or 30 years ago, I'd go out and buy a business and do what we used to call a leverage buyout, which means I would finance the assets.
Mm-hmm.
At a service business, all you have are pencils that you can hawk. At a manufacturing company, you have all that beautiful equipment out there. You have all the inventory. You have the accounts receivable. And if the company is doing well, you're going to be buying a manufacturing company that doesn't have any debt on it. So you can put that together. Now, keep in mind, if you work with me and bring the investors in, the day you take that business over and say it's a $10 million business, that $10 million business is free and clear. You have no debt on it. No debt. You know how tough it is to compete with somebody like people I work with that have companies with no debt? Because you can cut the price if you have to. And nobody else can because they got this damn debt hanging on them.
So let's do just a little talk on the cassettes. It teaches them how to finance assets. So that's still totally doable on smaller ones, right?
No, and larger ones.
And larger ones.
No, we were buying larger ones at the time. Same size we're buying now to finance assets. Now, when you're financing assets, that's why I prefer manufacturing. Because you have equipment, you have accounts receivable, you have inventory. A lot of times that you can go in and say, okay, I have a $10 million deal. I'm going to give you $2.5 million down, and you carry back financing. So we got the owners at that time to carry back maybe 50% of the operation. It was very simple to go out and borrow or lease back our assets. So I could use the equipment, I could use the accounts receivable. And our goal also was, even though we had owner financing, which we would structure to make sure it worked, and even though we had financing on the rest, on the equipment, we still had 50% of the cash flow left. Our rule has always been 50% or you don't do it.
All right, let me ask you this. But we also talked about you. Rarely did you find an owner with a $10 million business who wants to finance it.
That's right. So you're going to find most of the time what we were doing is financing more of the assets.
Okay, so more of the assets were financing, but was the owner still financing?
Well, we had more of it at that time because we were pushing for it.
But that can still be pushed for today.
We could push for it today. The problem is I owe cash and get a lower price. You know, back in those days, it did not bother me making payments, okay, because I wasn't used to doing anything else. But I'd gotten out and I spent 25 years with no payments. You couldn't get me back again.
So anyone going through the course, that's still a totally legitimate option that they can do on their own. If they can't work with you for whatever reason, or they don't want to mess with investors, they could still put the deal together by financing assets.
That's right.
And that's what the course talks about.
That's right. That's what we spent most of the time doing, and we just lucked into this other. So it was not a big master plan. We just lucked.
All right, very good, Art.
Okay.
All right, this guy also, he wanted to know if you would have any interest in your investors for financing a movie project. He sent me a business plan. I go, I don't know. I go, it sounds like.
How much does he need?
So he says there's one for $2 or $3 million and one for $100 million. And he's got a whole business plan. I said you'd have to talk to him. I go, it doesn't sound like a real, sounds like a risky proposition. I don't think he's going to be interested.
Yeah, we've never talked about that because I haven't had enough time to talk to you about all the business I've been involved in. But we first got involved in franchising back in the 60s. It came through a group that was in the movie business. They were called Rosslyn Bartlett. They did a lot of motorcycle movies. They took Anna Funicello and Frankie Avalon to the beach movies.
Yeah.
Well, then they went motorcycles and after the original beach. Dick Bartlett was with Universal. He was their director. And the other guy was a Superior Court judge. And they have a company making westerns, basically, cheese. And I worked with them on getting financing on a couple of them. But the thing I was really doing, two of us had a national franchise, the head of that company, and myself. That's a story in itself.
How risky is financing movies?
Really risky, because it depends on the person putting the deal together.
Yeah.
I mean, I hate to tell you how many people I have seen the business plan and then met them and knew they were slime. Everybody has these dreams. I could probably look at it, but I really don't feel like wasting my time. Have we done these in the past? Yes. Do I really want to do them again? No.
Hey, I watched the video your wife sent me. That was great. With Joe Kosman and Robert Allen. That ran on TV, right?
Oh, are you kidding? It ran all the time. So Robert Allen was putting his program on. He was using that to sell his...
He seemed like the main guy.
Yeah, well, it was his program. And if you read Robert Allen's first book, Nothing Down,
yeah,
in there he talks about buying businesses, and he recommends me. And every time Simon Schuster redoes that book, they call me to get my new latest phone number.
No kidding. You're in his Nothing Down book?
Oh, yeah. Al Lowry's book on business.
Uh-huh.
I'm the one. Well, the reason that Larry put me in there, the guy that he wrote the book with, Coleman, on business, came to me first. He wanted me to put my name on it and work with him. And the people that worked with me thought he was such a scumbag business broker. I had to tell him I couldn't do it. So
okay.
I did it.
Hi, Michael. Just to ask, are there any updates to the audios that Art has done recently? Also, could you ask him on the first meeting with the seller, what should I be looking for to get from the seller on this first meeting? Example, what questions should I ask, etc.?
Okay, well, the thing to keep in mind, what you're trying to do is get to know the other party. And that's why at your first meeting, you should not try to cut it short unless you find out it's not what you want to buy. Years ago, we used to sit down first meeting maybe for an hour. Today, we go 2, 3, 4 hours if it looks good on the larger businesses. The thing to keep in mind is if you do nothing more at your first meeting than establish rapport and a relationship with the seller, you're going to be very well off, because if you try to get financing or you want them to do certain things, they're not going to do it unless they know you. So try to get to know them. So what's going to happen is you're probably going to spend about 12 to 15 minutes discussing things that are important, I mean numbers in the business, stuff like that, and the rest of the time you're going to be talking about family, sports, whatever you want to talk about to get to know the other party. And you're going to find that as it goes on, it's going to become better and better. Now, when you go in there, you're trying to find out, first of all, do they still want to sell? And you're going to say, well, it's ridiculous. The guy said he wanted to sell. Well, that might have been 2 days ago. So do you want to sell? And they'll say yes. Why are you selling? Because you're trying to find a reason. You're going to sell it. Ill health. In fact, years ago, we put together a form with all the basic information on for businesses. And up in the corner, we had reason for selling. And so many people wrote in ill health that when I redid the form, being a smartass, excuse me for saying that, but what I did is I put down reason for selling, ill health, check if other.
So generally, when someone says ill health, that's not the real reason.
That's right. And what you have to do is find out what it is, because if it's another reason, and it will be, it could be something that's going to screw you up when you buy that company. So you're trying to find that out, because you may not want to buy it. Now, as we get into this, what we're going to do is we're trying to find out what the price is. Now, there's a lot of cutesy brokers around the country that have talked to their clients about the fact that if they don't give the buyer a price, the buyer will pay even more money. Well, you can talk to anybody in this country, since I spend a lot of time buying businesses, and you'll find that when a broker tells me there's no price on it, or the seller says he doesn't know, I won't even go across the street to talk to him. The hell with it, because it's a game they're playing. If they want to play games, they can play. And the other thing is, I have found that if I'm willing to pay a certain price at X number of dollars, and the other party wants a lot more than that, in all the years I've been doing this, I've been doing this 50-some years, I have never, never, ever gotten the seller to back off enough to get close enough to put a deal together. Don't waste your time. So what you try to do is find out what the price is. Now, you can still ask him about financing again. If you're working with me, we can go in and pay all cash with the investors we have. That's no problem for me or for them if they're working with me. Now, what you should do still is ask about financing, because it may be a good start. It'll also enable you to understand one thing, and that is one of the reasons we stay away from owner financing is all the conditions. If the business is making over $1 million a year, the chance of you getting that seller to finance anything is little remote and none, even if you put up your kids, your house, and everything else. Because every one of them have heard horror stories about having to take the business back, and they don't want to do it. So they would rather not sell it at this time than give up financing. But I still bounce it off them. Also, it's a good experience when you're first starting, because you'll say, okay, the broker got the seller to say he'll finance. So that's what he says when you first talk to him. And then you say, okay, will you take the business as collateral on this loan you're going to give me? And the owner will say, no, I want a bank guarantee, or I want real estate. And what you're going to find is, again, you might as well experiment on the first one. What you're going to find is, even though they say they'll finance, the average person selling a business any place on this planet does not want to carry back financing, no matter what you put up as collateral. And so what happens is, if you have a situation like you're working with me and you're able to pay all cash on these things, it cuts out all your competition, because very few of your competitors that are going in to buy that company are going to be able to buy it, because they don't have the all cash. They don't have it available. So it's cut out a lot of people. Now, again, you're trying to find out how long the owner will stay, things like that. But the key thing you really need to know is, okay, will you sell? What's the price on it? Are there terms? Will you stay a while? And that's what you're trying to find out. Now, when you get to the end of the meeting, what's going to happen is you're going to say to the owner, okay, you provided me with 1 year's financials, a P&L balance sheet. What I'd like to do is have P&L and balance sheets for the last 3 years and this year to date. And that's really all you need. Because don't start putting together a lot of information, because you may find after you leave there and go back to your office and go through this that it's crap and you don't want to go ahead on it. So don't waste your time building up a lot of paper. Do it on a gradual basis.
So only if it looks like it could be promising, ask them for the last 3 years of financials.
Right. But keep in mind one thing. When you go in there, you are the person with the cash. You're the person in control. This person wants to sell this business to you. So the basic thing, just to keep in mind, don't sweat the small stuff. If you end up leaving the meeting and you've only gotten part of the information and you two are getting along famously, you've just solved all your problems. Again, on the first one, you may even blow the first one by doing this, but keep in mind, go in there and try to get to know them. They're not going to try to rush you off and say, God, you've been here half an hour, I want you out now. They're never going to say that.
Mm-hmm.
What's going to happen is you're going to be sitting there, and all of a sudden it's going to be 3 hours later.
Okay. Well, this leads into a question from Anthony. He says, hi, Michael. I have some questions about Art Hamill's business buying course. If I approach sellers that I have a team of investors, I could see that they wouldn't question my ability to purchase their business. But my question is, gathering my team of investors seems to be difficult, at least initially, with no experience owning a business. Having the credibility of an experienced business owner like Art Hamill and his investment pool would be very advantageous when approaching sellers. Are his services still available, and is he available for consultation on the phone where I can talk to him about purchasing a business? I'd like to talk to him about what are the criterias that Art or his investors look for in a business to invest in, and various other questions. These guys want to know, how can they use your credibility while they're out talking to these businesses if they want to pursue and work with you to help them get the financing?
Okay, well, the problem is, no matter what they do with me, I don't come in until after I have seen a completed business plan and a contract. And so I can't talk to them, because what will happen if I say, would you talk to my seller, would you talk to the broker? If I try to do that, the problem they would ask me for, they would ask me for guarantees. And I would have to tell them that I haven't received enough information, I don't have a contract that I can look at, and I don't see a business plan. And with without that, I can't make a commitment. So what's going to happen is if they do try to get them to get a hold of me, I'm going to end up irritating the person they're working with. What I have to say.
But what can they say when they're in the meeting and you know, the guy doesn't have business experience and he wants to use you and your credibility to get them to open up or whatever? What are they allowed to say, basically?
Well, why don't you just do a simple thing? Why don't you just refer them to your website? And right below that, there's the SEC website. Tell me one, Google. And then right below it, there's a biography that I put together for the Society of Exchange Counselors. And so right on that site, on Google, right below it, is they can click in and get a 3-page background on me. It'll prove to them that I'm real. They then, if they'd like to, can go out in the real world because I'm still very well known because I've been around so damn long. But tell them what they have to realize. Here's what happens. They work with me. They give me the business plans that I've worked on with them. I get the contract I've worked on with them. And then what will happen is I will come and visit their facility. Okay, they should understand this. I'll come in. I'll go back to St. Louis, meet with them at their facility, and meet them probably for the first time. Sometimes I know the people ahead of time. Sometimes I don't, the buyers. So I'll get back there, get to know them. I'll spend 2 or 3 days getting to know them because I have to be able to go to the investors and say, look, I met with a buyer. I've been working with a buyer for the last couple of months. He's really a good person. He or she is really a good person, and I think it ought to go ahead. And so I also have to check the business because the last thing you do is go to an investor that's putting up $1 million or $2 million and tell him, you know, he'll ask, have you seen the business? No. Have you met the buyer? No. So what does the investor say? No. So what happened is I have to go back. I have to do this. At that time, I will then talk to the seller. I will talk to the broker, explain to him what I do. I also tell them that this is Friday of this week, and by Friday of next week, you, the buyer, will be getting an email from me or a fax, whichever one the person wants, on Thursday afternoon or Friday morning, which will describe all my activity during the week, that I met client A Monday morning, and client A is interested in putting in $2 million, et cetera, et cetera. The person's name, their phone number, their address, their attorney, their CPA. So if the person I'm working with, the buyer, wants to check this out or call him, talk to him, or whatever, he can do that. All I ask him to do is not let the seller do that because he'll screw up my investors. They're not going to be able to steal the investors. There's no way that's going to happen. But we don't want them getting a lot of phone calls. Now, what happens is every Friday I'll be calling you. I'll be reviewing what happened during the week. You'll already have the sheet to put in your notebook. I don't want you sitting there trying to take notes while you're talking to me. So it'll be down on a week-by-week basis. You'll then see what the status is. There's usually by the end of the first week, we are working with enough people with enough money to put your deal together, and it's going to make you feel a lot better. Now, what happened is about a year ago, we had a person we were working with in Florida, and he's having trouble from the seller and the broker and all this other. I said, did you get your sheet on Friday? He said, yes. I said, when are you going to see him? They said, tomorrow. This was Tuesday, so we're going to see him Wednesday. I said, look, make a couple of copies of it. When you meet with them, give them each a copy of this. He said, oh, they shouldn't have this information. I said, why not? I said, we're not playing games with this. There's nothing secret about this. There's not a chance in hell that they can go around me to the investors because I work with these guys for 25 years. So there's no problem. So I'm saying you have to get it to that point. I understand what they're going through. There's a lot of pressure from these people, especially when you have a broker involved, trying to qualify you. So what you're going to find is no matter what you do, you have problems. But keep in mind, when I go out to buy a business, unless I've known the broker or the seller from other deals, I go through the same crap everybody does.
Here's a question from Chris. He just recently ordered the course. Very excited. He goes, Michael, I'm up to tape 6 so far. I was wondering if art covers any ground with regards to negotiating and the actual art or science of deal making. If not, do you have any good or recommend sources of materials that cover this area?
You know, let me just say something. Even when we were teaching the course, we glossed over this because the art of the deal, you know, we're not in here negotiating the takeover of General Motors or something like that. You're buying a small business. You're going in. You're in the driver's seat because you're the buyer. You're the one coming in with the cash. And there's no great technique because all you're trying to do is, first of all, you know from pre-analysis that business that you're looking at market-wise is worth a certain amount, and they're in the ballpark, okay? So when you go in there, you're just gathering information, and you're seeing what your gut level is. I have been doing this for 50-some years. You know how often I have negotiated a deal? I never negotiate. And what happens is when I get down to the end, and especially in the last 10 years, many of the sellers of the business will stay around, we'll pay them all cash, they will stay around and continue to manage the company.
Mm-hmm.
Why will they do this? We become friends. I have not given them a hard time. I have not hardball negotiated. I mean, what you do is don't try to go after businesses where they're in trouble and you're trying to steal something. Don't try to go in there and cut a better deal. In other words, I'm willing to go in there and pay market for it. Okay? If they're willing to sell it for market, then we have a deal. There is no tough, rough negotiation that goes on, and I have never done that. And all I'm saying is you can listen to this horse shit from Donald Trump. And all I can tell you is my hair looks a hell of a lot better than Donald.
That's funny. Except that bald spot in the back where people keep batting you.
Yeah, they do. They keep people haven't heard that. Every time somebody would ask me what kind of business I bought, I would tell them. And since I've always bought basically boring businesses, they always pat me on the head. And because of that, my hair is gone.
Okay, here's a question from Travis, who ordered your course. He says, from the ending of that recording, this was the recording he listened to on the 25-point checklist, it sounded like Art and yourself were going to continue on to discuss some sort of document which might help people reinforce their relationship with Art in his group of investors or the process involved once a purchase agreement has been established.
Okay, but you see, when they get to the point and they say, okay, I want to talk to you on the phone. We talk to them on the phone. And then if they decide they want to spend the time bringing the investors in and doing all of that, the documents that I fax or email to them cover all this. They tell them exactly what the order is going to be and how we do things. Until we get to the point where we're about to do something, it's meaningless to send people information on what we might do if they would do something. Before they sign any agreement on paying a fee, they'll have all the information in writing, and it's something they can share with the seller and with the broker.
Okay. Perhaps I was naive in my original listenings of all the recordings and details on your site. Admittedly, from those things, I had great excitement about the possibility of teaming up with Art to put together not just one, but a few business purchases. It's easy to imagine that Art's time is continually wasted by people bringing him business plans that do not suit his requirements. Even in some recordings, he mentions people trying to bring deals together that just don't match his strict criteria. As Art says, look at 100 businesses, then you won't be so scared to throw them away if they aren't ideal. It was always my intention to follow Art's directions to the letter, that this would be the only way to ensure that I don't spend time and money on opportunities he is not interested in. For a guy like me who has recently gone the route of trying to start things from scratch, it was a huge eye-opener to listen to Art's recordings. My talents are in the area of maximizing business processes, not in starting something from scratch. Why I had never considered buying an existing business is embarrassing. This would have saved me from my last costly startup venture, where after 18 months my partner never came through on the side of the deal. The experience has provided valuable lessons and made Art's recordings ring even truer for me. So my question is, I live in a province of Canada where there is not much manufacturing. To locate ideal manufacturing prospects with over $3 million profit, I will likely have to travel to other provinces as part of my due diligence. I realize this represents very minor investment in return to the scope of the businesses Art suggests I pursue, although I'm willing to invest the $30,000 to $50,000 I expect will be needed to get through screening a lot of businesses, doing the due diligence and then funding Art's due diligence trips. At that point, I expect my well will be completely dry and I would have to have closed on a deal. From yesterday's recording, I get the impression that there is not enough value in getting into these deals for Art to be interested unless I have a significant investment and adequate management experience. This was quite different than my impression from the previous recording. I fear that I will not not be able to provide any significant investment in the actual purchase of the business. Can Art please give any clear indications of what kinds of candidates and business plans are likely to keep his interest? Does he have any minimum type of investment or management experience that he expects to see from those bringing him business plans? Perhaps I should only be considering options other than Art that his group and his group of investors.
Tell him welcome to the club. I mean, I started out starting businesses too. Until it dawned on me that buying existing ones made more sense. I think everybody's going through the same thing because it seems, God, if I don't have much money, I better start a business. As opposed to buying an existing one, the opposite is true. Now, everybody always asks me about the fact how much money they need on the thing. Well, if he has 30, 40, 50,000, whatever he's talking about, and he's going to be putting that in, or he's going to use that up by the time he gets there, that doesn't really happen because what happens is he may be spending a couple thousand dollars on me. Okay, at $150 an hour until he gets to the point where he does something, but he gets that back. In other words, it's like money in the bank. As soon as he puts a deal together, at the close of escrow, he gets all that money back. Also, when I go out to get funds, and I go out to the investors, I'll bring in enough money to cover the cost of the purchase of the business, enough money for working capital, whatever the buyer decides he needs for working capital, enough to cover my fee, and any other expenses that I have or anybody else has. And so everything is basically covered. In other words, whatever the amount is that he needs, if he's buying a $10 million business and he needs a total of 12 or 13, that's what he's going to end up getting in closed escrow. Now, the other amount that he's putting up is basically the tokenism, because what every investor worries about, I don't care with me or anybody else on this planet, is if you haven't invested anything and you buy a larger company, if something goes wrong, you're going to walk away. And so the amount you're putting up has to be enough to satisfy the investor so that they know you're not going to walk away. Or if you have a house, you're going to put a second on it. I don't mean there's going to be payments, but there's going to be something that you forfeit if you just walk away from the project. And that's the thing people are looking for.
Okay, so maybe if you own a home, you could plan on putting a second on the home, possibly?
Right. Again, a second that doesn't have payments on it, it's just a security thing. Or if you have a valuable stamp collection, whatever it happens to be.
You got to have some skin in the game.
Yeah, some skin in the game. That's what it is. It has nothing to do with you can work with me and my investors or anybody else on this planet, and you're going to run into the same thing all the time. If you haven't invested anything, you're not going to put it together. Because people that put up $1 million and the people that we have do put up a minimum of $1 million are not stupid. Most of the people that I work with, the investors I work with, own manufacturing companies. All of them own businesses. And so you're going to find that they're not bankers. They're not worried about ratios. They want to know that, number one, you're not going to walk away.
This is the end of part one. Please continue to part two.